Jen Riggs graduated law school and dove headfirst into stress as a public defender. During our conversation, Jen reflects on the burnout that came quickly. She walked away from the law without a plan and boarded a plane to London. This began Jen's journey of deep personal growth that today finds her as an expert in mindfulness-based leadership development. Jen offers digestible reflections that she believes would have changed her life in the law had she known then what she knows now. Jen offers thoughts on having perspective, purpose, and people around you for support. Jen makes mindfulness relatable and attainable. As she says during our conversation, being mindful does not require you to sit on a cushion for 20 minutes a day chanting Om. Rather, it is about stepping into the present moment, grounding in your body, and taking a breath. Enjoy this episode of Iron Advocate as we continue to explore how lawyers can kill it in the practice of law without it killing us.
You're listening to Iron Advocate, the podcast dedicated to you, the trial attorney, sage, visionary, warrior, unfiltered, no holds barred, Iron Advocate. Join Bob Levant, Jeff Riebel, and today's top legal minds on a journey to discover how to kill it in the law without it killing you. Because being the best advocate for others begins with being the best advocate for yourself.
Hey, Jen, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so tell us what you do and why you think it would matter for lawyers.
I do leadership development. And in that, I integrate a model that uses neuroscience, coaching, and mindfulness principles for leadership development and change. So why does that matter for lawyers? Well, it's about personal and professional development and growth. And in a word, the point of the model and the work that I do is integration. That's sort of Dr. Dan Siegel is a guide for me in my framework. And integration means we are learning and through the exercises and coaching that I do, integrating our brains and our nervous systems for not just for wellness, but for higher functioning, cognitive functioning. So lawyers definitely could use that.
So Jen, if I came to you just hypothetically and said I was a trial lawyer, I'm anxious before depositions, I feel like I want to kill my opponent sometimes, I can't stand my clients, I can't sleep at night, what would you help me do? Where would you start me?
Yeah, well, that's a lot. but I would, first of all, I would say congratulations for being aware of that and for admitting it and saying it out loud. I would start with that. I would say you're one step ahead of some. and then I would, you know, I use neuroscience in my approach because it grounds the work and the coaching and what I do in science. So it's not just woo-woo and mindfulness, and the mind-body connection is not woo-woo, it's grounded in neuroscience. So there are two ways to go at what we might call self-regulation, which a lawyer in that circumstance would need to work on. One I call top down. And that's when if you're able to just sort of shift your mindset and your thinking in the moment, I got to stop being angry. And so I'm going to shift to this. But let's face it, that is very often out of reach, especially when we're emotionally triggered and we're sort of deep into those neural pathways of emotional reactivity. So then we talk about the bottom-up approach. And that's when you use the body and the breath to ground yourself, which triggers the brain through the nervous system is constantly sending signals up into the brain about the status of the body. And when you can relax the body or deepen the breath, then that actually slows the mind down. And so that we would work on the mind-body connection as a starting point for shifting. And then after that, then the cognitive element becomes more accessible over time.
So Jen, go ahead, Jeff.
Real quick, you said something I thought was critical. You said slowing the mind down. Mm. And that's something that Bob and I are constantly talking about. Slowing.
No problem here. No problem with that at all, Jeff. No problem. Go ahead.
So there's just, if you could help a complete neophyte listening to this, somebody who they've heard mindfulness, you know, in their reading of the New York Times, maybe one time, but they didn't really know about it. And they just wanted to get them to slow down. What would be just one or two things they could start with, just really simple things?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that question, because we do need to break it down, right? It can feel like a little overwhelming, and even just the idea of trying mindfulness, it's sort of like yeah, who has time for this, and sounds good, but I got work to do. So I would say it's just about pausing and breathing. So if you can just pause, take a breath or two, notice what you notice in the present moment, and then move from there. So it's really, mindfulness isn't about stopping the mind from thinking. It's not about not thinking. If we believe that, which I did when I first started to try to meditate, I thought my mind was going to explode, and I thought, I'm just failing at this. This is no good. It really doesn't require you to sit on a cushion for 20 minutes a day and chant Om. You know, it's about stepping into the present moment, grounding in your body, take a breath. Just take a breath. And then the breath, neuroscience, there's more and more research being done on the power of the breath to change the neural patterns and pathways in the brain. And if you just think about it like this, if you stop the body and take a deep breath or two, doesn't it make sense that that is a signal to the brain that you're not needing to run from danger, that we're not escaping from the bear in the woods, that, the body's stopped and I'm breathing deeply. I must be safe. And safety is what the brain and nervous system, that's like the critical need before it can create change.
So Jen, in order for like the listeners to really appreciate how you've come to embody this, can you take us back to law school or your early days as a lawyer and try to help the listeners realize from where it is that you've come and how your experience in the law is part of your journey to where you are?
Yeah. How much time do we have? No.
This is rich with...
Where have I come from, Bob? I've come a long way. So let's just like, in fact, if I could explain it really briefly, when we integrate our brain and our nervous system and our mind and body, we are able to start to shift not just our states of mind, but our traits. So for example, when I was before law school, but this certainly continued through law school when I was a young lawyer, I was voted like class pessimist. In high school.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah. So that was, among other things, but anyway, so that was a trait that I had. I was a pessimist, and I really, my motto was expect the worst, so you won't be disappointed. And that followed me as a lawyer. And anyway, I would say through my work and my own development, that is not the case anymore. I'm definitely not a pessimist. I'm able to see the optimistic side of things. But that was sort of a little bit of a a big picture answer to your question. Can you go back to that if you want to know some more details?
Yeah. I want to ask you details about how you felt as you were a public defender, how you felt as a young lawyer, and what either pushed you or drove you out of the law, and how that might have been different if you knew then what you know now.
Yeah. I would say I basically burnt out, and I burnt out quickly. I was super stressed, and it affected my health, affected my body. And I didn't know it then, but I know now that it affected my brain and my abilities. And no one was talking about it then. In fact, it was sort of, you're afraid to show any weakness, especially, in law school and as a young lawyer. It's like, you've got to be the super lawyer, and you're competing against everyone else. And there's no room for vulnerability. So I internalized what I was feeling, the stress of it. I internalized it, and it took a toll on my well-being. So I burnt out. And I left without a plan, which was really uncharacteristic of me.
Was that a good thing?
I think it's indicative of how unhappy I was, and how, it's sort of like everything in me was saying, Jen, you got to get out. Like, this is not good for you. You got to get out. But even though I was a real planner, but I just sort of took the leap, and I went to London for a while without a job.
Sounds like a nice thing to do. But quick question about that. So other than going to London, if you would have had the tools available that you're describing, and you would have had, let's say, the version of you that we're talking to today could have appeared to the younger version of you and mentored you and sort of held you, what difference would it have made in your life, do you think, as a lawyer and as a human being?
Mm-hmm. It would have made a huge difference. I was thinking about, knowing that we were going to talk, thinking about what are the things that I would want someone in my position to know that I didn't know then. And I would say sort of like three things. One is perspective, and I would combine that with purpose, like perspective and purpose. When you're in law school and when you're a young lawyer, you kind of lose perspective. It's like, it's all about, your rank in class, and are you going to make law review, and, your upcoming exams. And it's really easy to lose perspective. And with that, I would relate it to purpose, like to remember or to know before you start, what's your why? I don't think I really knew when I knew I loved to argue, and I was sort of, I wanted to fight for the underdog, but I didn't have a big picture in mind. I didn't really have an anchor, a purpose, as I was moving through it. And I think about how I recently read about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, or maybe it was in the documentary, but when she was in law school, she was married and she had a baby. And then her husband had cancer. And she's at Harvard Law, and she works her butt off when she's in class, and she comes home and cares for her baby for, from like say 4 to whenever the baby goes to bed. And then she works really hard at night. And then when her husband had cancer, she also got his notes from class, from his students in his classes, and helped him as well. And she said that she actually felt that that gave her an advantage. I would think like, oh my God, I could never do that. That's like, how could you juggle all of that? But she said it gave her perspective, because she realized there were other things in life. She had a child, and she had a husband, who was sick. So perspective and purpose. And the second thing would be about self-care. which is part of my framework. I like to say self-care is brain care. It's not selfish. It's not self-indulgent. It's about caring for your physical health, sleep, diet, exercise, but all of that affects your brain and your neurological functioning and your emotional health as well. Three is, in my words, I'd say find your peeps. Support and social connection is really important. Find the people that you feel you can be your authentic self with. You can talk about, the stress and that you can just be real with, both colleagues and mentors.
Jen, that advice that you would have said to your younger self, that you gave it in terms of sort of a checklist. How would you have needed to hear that back then? How would you, as a young, struggling, neurotic, scared, all the things you were, right? We can all imagine ourselves. We all remember what that was like. How would that need to have been imparted to you?
That's a good question. Because sort of as I mentioned earlier, someone came in response to your question, someone came to you and they told me they were, they were getting angry and they're this, because it starts with awareness, right? Because you can't change what you're not aware of. And I was recently talking to someone who works at a law school who was saying, I don't even know if these students know that they're close to burnout. So what would I have need to know? I think it would have been about long-term well-being, functioning, and happiness.
Is it information you would have needed, or would you needed a way of somebody just saying to you, it's okay, and this is normal what you're feeling, and here are some tools, here's something. Because I think about it, Bob and I had this discussion, how could we have helped ourselves at a younger age? And would we even have been ready to hear what somebody as wise and as versed in the literature and the science as you are right now? Could we even have heard that at that time in our lives? And that's where my question is sort of directed.
And that's a really good question. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges in bringing what I do into the legal profession and young lawyers. And I would say that it starts with just acknowledgement and acceptance. Like if you're feeling stressed, if you're feeling scared, if you're doubting yourself, all of that, that it's okay, that it's natural, that it's understandable, that you're not the only one.
It shows the person to the left, the right, in front of you, behind you.
Exactly.
And all around the room. And I guess that, you have this unique spot where you understand the science of it now, but back then, it's such a lonely place that, how granularly do we have to say it to law students and young lawyers and how do we have to shift the culture? Does it, right. That's, I guess what the follow-up from me is how back, if you put yourself back then, what form would it have taken for you to actually say, wow, that's right.
Yep. I think that it's really helpful when we're looking at large change, or systemic change, or organizational change, professional change, that it comes from the top down, that someone at the top says, this is okay, this is real. that someone at the top has the courage to say, that's how I felt. And then you have permission to say, oh God, all right, phew, you know? So it doesn't get internalized.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I mean, what would that have been for you back then?
Yeah. And so I want to say too, though, and I'll answer that question, I think I'll try to, Jeff, but I want to say not just about like, okay, let's give the, you know, let's offer a webinar or a workshop for this firm or for these law students. And, you know, we're going to tick off the box because, okay, you know, stress resilience done. We did a 1-hour webinar. I think it needs more to stick. And that's what I mean about the top down. So like for me, who would it have been? I mean, one of my challenges, and I wish I had, you know, done differently, is to have found, let's say in law school, to have made a strong connection with a professor that I trusted and admired. I didn't really have that. You know, I had some connections, and you know, but nothing, I didn't really develop a relationship where I could, you know, an authentic relationship that I felt like I could really turn to a professor or someone at the law school that I admired. And if I'd had that, then that person would have been the person who would have made it okay for me to recognize what, you know, what I was facing and to help me, to guide me.
I mean, the barriers in the profession are everywhere you turn. And, you know, you're hitting on these themes of if you had had a, you know, a mentor that could have shown that to you, if in fact that person was either aware or willing to name it. Jeff and I talk about our therapists, you know, all the time, which is taboo, you know, in the law, you know, any kind of sign of weakness. Is something that we're sort of ingrained in us. We're not kind of supposed to show. Right. And so, you know, that level of personal vulnerability is really hard to find in the law. And yet when you unlock it, of course, you know, it unlocks your, you know, whatever your greatest advocate or quite frankly, you know, I think true of any profession, but you know, you are, you know, everywhere you turn, you're told to swallow that, you know, vulnerability and not confront it. Does that have to be, in order for you to get into an organization to hear you in a meaningful way, do you feel like you have to just call that out directly? Like, this is what's going on? Or do we inch our way in?
What was the or?
Or do we have to, you know, nibble on the edges? You know, you know, we have to go right at this and say, listen, this is why the culture is so unhealthy. This is why the numbers of depression, alcohol, substance abuse is so high. You know, let's just name it. And you're all like this. Okay. You all behave like this, you know, period. And so I can help you. Of course, you might face more resistance. However, if we nibble on the edges, you know, what are we really doing?
Right. And, you know, and we've talked about that before, and the whole, you know, when the ABA came out with that, gosh, was it 2 or 3 years ago now? But the
That's right.
Report on lawyer well-being. And I was so excited. I thought, oh, wow, this is going to be, you know, the beginning of the change. And here we are at least a couple of years later. And what's happened? So I feel like, again, that it's sort of a, okay, people know that it's a problem, but there's just right now, it's still, my sense is, it's just still a little bit of lip service that it really does need to take some courageous people at the top of an organization, or, you know, whether that be a firm or a bar association or a law school to call it out and to be vulnerable and to really invest in a change.
Yeah, and that's what, Jen, you know, obviously we're trying to do that, and I know you're doing that, and that's why we want to do on. I have another practical question for a listener who has some of the qualities that we described in that very hypothetical person that was talked about at the beginning of our conversation. I don't know
how hypothetical it is.
If that, it describes Bob probably pretty well, but if that person came to you pretty much a neophyte, but they heard about you and they heard what a handle you had on these issues and how smart and compassionate you were. And they said, look, I just don't have time. When can I expect results? Can you just give me a program of 20 pushups, 100 burpees, and I'll get on the Peloton for half. Can you just give me a program like that? If they said that to you, what would be a reasonable expectation for somebody like that, a bottom line kind of left brain person, to expect for them to see some kind of results? How long should they stick with it? So this is a question about for our listeners. How long do they have to put into this to start to see something?
I wish I had, a black and white answer for that, just how I wish the law were black and white, and I soon learned it wasn't. The answer is going to depend on the status of the person seeking the change, what their challenges are, sort of how far down maybe the stress or burnout scale they are. But some practices, I will say, some clients will notice a difference with a practice that I might do with that. There can be an immediate change directly after a practice, but then if they go away and work on something, and then they might notice a difference in a couple of weeks when I say, okay, well, when you did that, and then what did you notice? But there is no sort of magic bullet, let's change this overnight. It takes time, energy, and effort to change neural pathways. And I will say that to clients right up front, like it's not going to be, see you next week and everything's going to be great. It took a long time to create the neural pathways that we have, and we don't lose them, but we can, with practice and over time, kind of overtake them with new patterns.
So, Jen, I want to kind of wrap us up on this question. There are lawyers suffering and every day, if you can take yourself back to whatever the moment was of sort of sheer panic or ultimate dread that drove you, from the law. I know there are things about the law that you loved. If you're talking to lawyers who have that overwhelmed, stressed, just feeling a doom that they got to get out, but in their heart of hearts, they want to stay in the profession and they want to love being a lawyer. At that moment, what would you tell them to do to be able to slow things down and shift their vision in a way that they can find their way in the law to a place of peace and happiness?
They need a reset button, and how fast or what that reset button entails might depend. But if you could just take the vacation that you haven't taken, right? And then come back more rested. We need physical energy. The brain needs energy to make change. So if we can just start by starting with that self-care that I talked about, the diet, exercise, and start building up, shoring up those resources so your brain has the energy to make the changes that you want to start to make.
That's solid practical advice that I think, lawyers don't take enough. So you know, this has been really, I mean, it's been fun. It's been like deep and informative. And, you know, we urge anybody out there that's listening, any firms out there to check Jen out. Where can they find you on the net, Jen?
JenRiggs.com.
Easy enough. It'll be in the liner notes of the episode with a hyperlink. So give her a call. Thanks again, Jen.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Iron Advocate and that you take what you've learned and integrate it into your own personal practice. As always, we leave you with a minute of mindfulness. Breathe in, breathe out, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.